RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
Dr. Max Gulhane is a practicing Australian health optimizing physician and health educator. He wants to help us thrive, not merely survive. He's at drmaxgulhane.com. And Max joins us for our health hacks this Monday here at RCR. Max, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Health optimizing. Okay, so we're assuming that you're kind of healthy already, but we can optimize that. Am I coming from the right direction?
Look, there's a lot of facets to this, but essentially it's framing medical care in a different way than it is currently practiced. And you mentioned this idea about thriving and not merely surviving. And really that is, I guess, the standard of care as it is intended, which is we're really good at getting you from dying to surviving. But the next step from surviving to thriving isn't mainstream medical, Western medicine's forte. And again, that's not to talk shade on the amazing benefits of acute emergency care, acute surgical care. I mean, absolutely tremendous. But what we don't do well is with chronic disease, with diabetes, with obesity, with neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease and cancer and autoimmune disease and psychiatric illness. So these are conditions which you can't medicate to optimal health. And really that's the thrust of my message, which is if you want to thrive, then you really have to start looking at a lifestyle and environmental factors that you're exposed to and that you do on a daily basis, because this is going to be the difference between simply just getting by, just surviving and thriving, which I think everyone wants to do to basically live as healthy as they can for as long as they can, and having a shorter period of illness right at the end of a hopefully long and happy life.
Okay, does that mean if you want to be healthy, don't live in a city?
Well, there are challenges of living in a city that are inherent in, I guess, or the way to think about it is how is that the environment in which we adapted as humans over our period of time on planet Earth? And the answer is a resounding no. So there are many different facets of city living that make it extremely difficult to thrive. So happy to go into the specifics if you'd like. But the question as it's framed, I would agree with.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of, just taking the entirety of an environment into account. Cities tend to be polluted. They don't have many natural landforms in them, do they? It's basically concrete or tar seal, etc. Okay, what is the role, and this is of great interest to our audience, of, we know about vitamin D, but vitamin D through ultraviolet light through the skin. There seems to be a difference between, sort of taking it as a supplement and using the process of, I guess, a conversion of, ultraviolet light into the manufacture of that vitamin D. You make it, right? Have I got that right?
That's correct. So in this kind of realm of medicine, which is what we call photobiology, which is the interactions of light with our human body, the vitamin D pathway is the most well known, and people are aware of the fact that this is a vitamin, but it's actually a hormone that is made only when we get a certain type of light onto our skin. Now, the difference here, and maybe to give people a bit of context, is why is vitamin D important? And vitamin D is ancient. It's more than 500 million years old, and it has a very old and what we call an evolutionary conserved value in organisms. And what it has come to do for us as humans, most basically, is to help us absorb calcium from the gut so we can form healthy bones. And that is commonly what people associate vitamin D with. But really, it's so much more than that. And when we've understood now that vitamin D plays a role in modulating a whole bunch of incredibly important processes in the body, perhaps of interest to your listeners is in its role as an basically an anti-cancer pathways, as well as modulating the immune system and therefore affecting our likelihood of developing an autoimmune diseases, but also affecting our immune system's ability to fight off infection. So vitamin D deficiency and insufficiency touches so many different pathways and factors that are important for optimal health. So we want a robust vitamin D level. So the next question, I guess, which is relevant, which is, can I just take a pill?
Yeah, that is the next question. Yep.
And really the answer is a resounding no. And the reason it's a resounding no is because vitamin D is on its own, this compound is not the only compound that gets made when UVB light strikes the skin. Right. There is a constellation of related compounds, which are called secosteroids, that have incredibly important biological activity that you're not going to get from taking the purified 1,000 units of vitamin D, cholecalciferol from the pharmacy. And this should make intuitive sense to people, which is it doesn't on any way, shape, or form make sense that we could distill the health benefits of full-spectrum sunlight exposure into a pill. And yes, there are certain indications where supplementation is beneficial, and that's particularly for people that are extremely deficient in order to reverse severe deficiency, bone-related conditions like rickets and severe vitamin D deficiency. But for most of your listeners who are perhaps interested in health optimization, this vitamin D level, especially as the doctors measure it, it's really a biomarker of your sunlight exposure. And that's how I think is the most useful way of thinking about it. And sunlight has a range of benefits that are related to vitamin D, but a whole bunch that are unrelated to vitamin D. But simply using our vitamin D level as a proxy of our sun exposure can help guide us in terms of understanding if we're sunlight deficient or not.
Sunlight deficient, yeah, it's a good way of putting it. So why then is there a whole industry and now it's been worked up over quite some time, a fear of the very thing that is responsible for everything we ever see or are or whatever? It seems very counterintuitive.
Yes, and you're right, which is life on Earth is essentially, and this was described by Professor Robert Fosbury, who's an astrophysicist who's turned his hand to investigating light-life interactions. He basically put it this way: life on Earth is a antenna for solar radiation. And that statement really speaks to the fundamental irreplaceable role of sunlight to the entire biosphere. So, everything all the plants, obviously they photosynthesize, they use solar radiation and they suck in carbon dioxide and they fix that and they make what will later become your steak via the process of a cow eating it. So, humans derive energy as well from the sunlight. We don't use chlorophyll, we use melanin. And this is a biophysical process that is not in any way referred to in the mainstream medical orthodoxy. So the reason, I guess, to understand about why the sun has become demonized, my best guess would be because the settlers who've arrived in New Zealand, Australia, perhaps Southern Africa, we are inequipped to deal with, from a genetic endowment point of view, the massive amount of ultraviolet light that is present in the environment at our location, at our latitude.
Yep.
So if you compare the skin tone of a Northern European someone of that ancestry in Australia and New Zealand, compared to those who were here on arrival, there's a massive difference in the melanin in the skin and in the epidermis. And we have a scale in medicine, it's called the Fitzpatrick scale. And it's essentially a phototype, or it describes the amount of pigment in the skin and therefore the predisposition to sunburn. So what essentially has happened is that we have transplanted people to areas of a massively high UV yield. And in combination with a whole bunch of lifestyle practices that are I would say novel and inappropriate with regard to healthy skin exposure. We've developed an extremely high rate of skin cancer. So yeah. That is particularly in Australia and New Zealand why the narratives are so anti-sun. But what we do if we unpack some of these, the biology and the effect of sunlight on health, is that we really realize that it's not the sun itself, it's how people are exposing themselves to the sun.
The dosing you give yourself, can I put it like that?
Dosing is definitely one part of it. And, you know, in Australia, people go out in the middle of summer at midday, the UV index is 12, and they've got a Fitzpatrick skin type of 2, and they're in light that they have no business being in. And then they go home and they're exposed to artificial light. They eat, perhaps eating a diet that's rich in highly refined polyunsaturated seed oils. They have a disrupted circadian rhythm. They're not eating natural omega-3 fatty acids from seafood. And they're living, again, under artificial light. And, you know, 20 years, 30 years later, they develop a melanoma and they perhaps got burnt couple times a season between the age of 10 and 19. And then, you know, the sun gets blamed. So the point here is that we shouldn't be blaming the sun. We should.
That's a very good point you made. I hadn't thought of it like that. Yeah, because there's an automatic connection made with, oh, yes, I remember that time I got horribly burnt. That'll be where it happened. But the lag time is so much that
exactly.
How can, with any precision, can you claim any association? Everyone's been sunburnt.
Exactly. Right? So it's that period. It's that 20, 30, 40-year period. And then there's all kinds of basically inconsistencies in terms of making a causal link between melanoma, certain types of melanoma, and sun exposure. So yes, and there's melanomas in older people, the superficial type, you know, lentigo maligna, absolutely more likely in sun exposed areas, more associated with total UV exposure. But for things like superficial spreading melanoma, especially in younger people, there's associations with vitamin D deficiency. So the question here, and as well as the severity of melanoma, which is what we call, we analyze the thickness and it's termed a Breslow thickness to determine the severity of a melanoma. That is also associated with vitamin D deficiency. So this should prick up anyone's ears, which is if UVB light is you know, the sole cause of skin cancer. Why is deficiency of the only hormone we can make from ultraviolet B light? Sorry, the hormone that is made only from ultraviolet B light. Why is that associated with more severe melanoma phenotype? So these are questions that need to be asked.
Okay, so just to wrap the sun for the moment, if people want to expose themselves to the sun, I guess common sense applies, but you can kind of work up to it. Does your skin sort of get hardened, or does the you know, the tone in your skin kind of build up and allow you to tolerate it more? How does it work?
So the crux of sensible sun exposure, and I'm using the word sensible because I believe the narratives that we have, mainstream narratives, are extreme. They are extreme sun avoidance. They are the complete pathologization of ultraviolet light, and that is an extreme position that I don't believe is correct or in the holistic health benefit of most people. So to understand how to get sun safely, it actually starts with the morning, and it starts with circadian rhythms and circadian alignment. And the reason is because there is a 24-hour clock, a circadian clock mechanism, which runs a very intricate feedback loop in every single cell of your body, practically, except red blood cells and a couple of others. But this clock basically primes and tells the cell when to make different compounds at different times. And that's how your body operates. So having a aligned circadian rhythm means that the clocks in your skin cells, in your keratinocytes, in your melanocytes, are able to make the right adaptations to the ambient light conditions at the right time.
So the light conditions is the reference point for the rhythms, is it?
Exactly.
Light intensity or frequency or whatever.
Light wavelength at the is the prime Zeitgeber or time giver for your body's 24-hour clock or your circadian rhythm. It's light through the eye that tells the body what time of day it is. Sun, our resistance to sunburn is in part reliant on having an optimal circadian rhythm. And that is because light in the morning is completely deprived of ultraviolet light. And that is not something that anyone is told. You can't get sunburnt first thing in the morning, and you can't, you're really only likely to get sunburnt when ultraviolet B light shows up in your environment. And that is depending on your latitude, it's depending on your season, and it's depending on the time of day. So to get and to build up safe sun exposure, you basically need to ideally sunbathe the early morning red and infrared rich light, have full spectrum sunlight into the eye in the morning, and then progressively expose yourself without burning to shorter wavelength UVA and then UVB light. And what this does is that it sets off a cascade of pathways in the epidermis and the dermis that prepares the skin for the arrival of ultraviolet B light.
Oh, okay.
What that entails is fibroblasts and other cells upregulating the production of collagen, elastin. They prepare the skin. The actors actually, it's been shown experimentally that red light in the deep red 660 nanometers is equivalent to an SPF 15 sun protection factor.
Okay.
And so what that is doing is, again, it's priming the skin. What happens? Visible blue light, it has the same effect. When and to not get too technical, but I want to be precise here because of the degree of narrative against this advice. When blue light hits the skin, the non-visual photoreceptor melanopsin triggers a photoprotective upregulation of melanin in the melanocyte, which is amongst the first things that can help protect the skin from UV light. And then the immediate, once UVA arrives, around it's around 6:30 where I am in New South Wales and Australia, that itself starts an immediate pigment darkening process. So it's the immediate response to the ultraviolet A before the ultraviolet B comes out, which gets the skin ready by recruiting or oxidizing existing melanin granules. And then finally, when the ultraviolet B light comes out and you've had exposure for a prolonged period of time, and yes, it does a little bit of DNA damage, but that is part of upregulating the synthesis of melanin in the melanocytes that therefore then gets passed around to the keratinocytes and protects the skin layer. So yes, tanning is skin cells and trauma. That is a half truth. But the effect of that is to promote a hormetic beneficial melanin response that is, in the context of the whole body and the whole organism, is generates vitamin D, and it has a profoundly beneficial effect on the whole body's health.
I want to get onto artificial light before we're done, but just another question. So I get a suntan. I'm not burnt, but I got a tan. My skin is darker than it was when I first started. Is that some kind of protection?
It is. And if you're looking at what is happening right on the microscopic level, is that the melanin, which is the pigment, absorbs ultraviolet light, and it actually sits up on top of the nucleus of the cell to protect the genetic information. So it is absolutely a protective hormetic response.
So to artificial light before we're done, there seems, now I'm getting on in years, to be a whole lot more light sources than there were, you know. LED obviously is the big one, but there are all those weird street lights and everything that have been around for ages. It seems to me that the quality of the light has, I can perceive it and feel it, degraded. And it feels clinical and almost not like light.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So what's happened is we've refined light. Humanity has essentially distilled and refined light to a tiny fraction of the natural solar spectrum. And we've taken out the red, we've taken out the infrared, which you just heard has a photoprotective effect on the skin. And we have removed the ultraviolet light, and we've essentially created visible only lighting in that is extremely rich in the blue wavelength.
What does that do? What does that do to us?
Well, that it first and foremost, it disrupts our circadian rhythm, especially when we're exposed to it after dark. It tells the body that it's midday when the body should be going into a rest and recovery process. So what it does is it turns off a key circadian hormone called melatonin. And melatonin is a signal of the body, both the signal to wind down and to go to sleep and to initiate sleep. It's a signal that promotes depth of sleep. It's a signal that promotes repair, cellular repair. And when you're depriving your body of melatonin, it can't do critical repair mechanisms like cellular garbage cleaning that prevent cancer. And we know that artificial light at night particularly is associated with hormone-sensitive cancers like breast cancer and like prostate cancer. And this data is very, very strong, such that researchers have performed epidemiological studies investigating the prevalence of breast cancer, and it can't be found in societies that haven't electrified. So it's an extremely strong predictor and risk factor for developing breast cancer, but it's ubiquitous. It's absolutely everywhere, and people have no idea that when they're sitting at home on the couch, flicking through the iPad at 9 p.m. at night with their 86-inch television screen blasting blue light at them, and the cool white LED energy-saving downlights in the kitchen are all on. You know, the place is looking like a stadium. That is causing cancer, and yeah. It's causing diabetes, and it's causing obesity, and it's causing depression, anxiety, and psychiatric illness.
Well, no one's going to push back on lighting for a while. We're stuck with this stuff.
Well, the crux of the issue, Paul, is that governments have mandated a minimum energy saving requirement, which has specified a metric called lumens per watt. And this sounds like a good idea if you have no understanding of how human biology uses light and relies on light signals. So what this metric has forced is that it's forced manufacturers to produce highly, highly efficient, in quotation marks, lighting that fits this energy saving requirement, but the trade-off to meet those specifications is that they have to cut out the red and infrared, the longer wavelength light, which naturally comes from the sun, which we were exposed to in yesteryear that you referred to, when we used filament bulbs and incandescent bulbs as part of our indoor lighting system. So that wasn't ideal from a circadian biology point of view, but it was a lot better than fluorescent bulbs and this cool white LED that everyone is now exposed to. And as I mentioned, from the full gamut, from psychiatric illness to autism and neurodevelopmental issues to obesity, metabolic disease, there is biochemical and biophysical pathways physiologically to chart a path from that light exposure, from that circadian rhythm disruption to illness and chronic disease in those areas.
Haven't got time really to get to ancestral diets or ancestrally appropriate diets, but I'm thinking after hearing you talk, and it's been fascinating, thank you, that unless you had something, I don't know, left field, you know, 5,000 years ago in your village or whatever, and you were kind of tuned up to nature, probably if you were healthy, you were really healthy. Would that be right?
Yeah, I think that is the case, and the my interpretation of this, you know, this mortality, you know, there was a thought that people were, you know, sickly, ancestral people were sickly and lived short lives. I think it was Hobbes that made some, you know, Victorian era comment in some literature about primitive man being sickly and diseased. When you look at anthropological accounts of time in ancestral cultures, whether that was Weston Price or anyone else before them, these people were in robust health, and they lived, bar something like violent death or fall from a tree.
Yeah, I mean those things happen.
Tribal warfare.
Yeah,
and barring those or early life, you know, pediatric infant mortality, then, you know, barring those, conditional upon surviving those, people lived robustly with a long health span. And the crux of the ancestral dietary approach, it's actually dead simple. And it's so simple that it's just testament to how abominated the food system has become, which is simply eat what grows in your environment. And if you live in southern New Zealand in Dunedin or Invercargill in the middle of winter, there's not going to be a lot growing that's edible other than, you know, lamb, ruminant animals, and probably some tuberous type vegetables. So eating within our local area is the easiest heuristic that would solve most people's health problems. And if we pair it with the circadian point that I made prior to that, which is eat during daytime hours, because that is when the body is adapted to digestion and optimal processing of ingested nutrients. So the two most simple takeaway points from a dietary point of view is eat what grows within a 100-kilometer radius, let's say arbitrarily, and eat during daytime. If you do those two things, if they're your only food rules, then it's going to be very hard for you to become diabetic.
That's so simple. All right. It's been really interesting chatting with you, Max. Thanks for sharing your information. If people want to know more, they can go to drmaxgulhane.com. Is that a good place to go through and make contact if they want to?
Absolutely. Or check out my podcast, Regenerative Health Podcast, on Spotify or my YouTube channel when you just type my name in.
All right. I think I might go and get a bit of time in the sun after that. Nice to have you on. All the best. And maybe we'll talk again. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.